Welcome everyone to this podcast on time critical medical education. I'm Dr. Nick Taylor. I'm a senior emergency specialist based in Canberra. I was going to talk today about syncope, but then what happened was I ended up looking at the literature and found that syncope is just a massive topic. There are so many different causes of syncope that we'd be spending all day trying to cover them all. The reality is that if you look at syncopal patients, there are really only one major cause that causes most of the morbidity, both in those who we decide we want to admit, but also in those that we discharge and maybe admit the diagnosis. So today, I really want to cover the subgroup of patients who have sudden cardiac death. So sudden cardiac death is the second biggest killer in most Western nations to cancer. It's the biggest killer of young athletes. It makes up around 15 to 20% of all deaths. It's also a very big killer of young healthy people. Most fatal rhythms that are caught are ventricular fibrillation, but studies are now showing that maybe 40% of people don't have an arrhythmia, maybe just have complete cardiovascular collapse. Most of those who die of sudden cardiac death are those with acquired heart disease in the older population, not surprisingly. But more than 50% of patients with sudden cardiac death have had no previous diagnosis. So of this group of sudden cardiac death sufferers, only 1% are in those less than 35 years old. If we look at the breakdown of the diagnoses that kill everyone with sudden cardiac death, not surprisingly, 50 to 75% have coronary artery disease. 10 to 15% have non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, such as valvular disease or myocarditis. And then there's a sudden arrhythmic death syndrome. That only makes up 5% of the total numbers, but, and this is the important bit, it's 1/3 of the less than 35-year-olds. So what is sudden arrhythmic death syndrome? It makes up a group of the arrhythmogenic disorders, which includes the long QT syndrome, Brugada, early repolarization, we'll come to that a bit later, Wolff-Parkinson-White, short QT syndrome, and the catecholaminergic polymorphic VT, which is actually a really deadly illness causing bidirectional VT, which kills up to 30% by 30 years of age. So if a young person who's active outside comes in with exertional syncope, what should you do? Well, the risk assessment is that this should be assumed to be a sudden cardiac arrest until proven otherwise. And that's been shown in many papers, including Vettors et al., syncope as a warning symptom of sudden cardiac death in athletes, from Cardiology Clinics in 2015. If we look at the athlete data, and there is a lot of athlete data, not surprisingly, it's because there's been a lot of money put into the research. Athletes cost a fortune, and when they die, it's often high profile and very scary. So sporting clubs and sporting organisations have invested quite a lot in trying to work out if some of these deaths are preventable. So in an autopsy study by Finocchiaro, which is UK autopsy data published in the Journal of American Cardiology in 2016, you find that 43% of those athletes who've died, died of sudden arrhythmic death syndrome. LVH makes up 16%, arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy about 13%, coronary artery disease about 7%, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy about 6%, dilated cardiomyopathy about 3%, and all others about 12%. In some studies, this sudden arrhythmic death syndrome group can be reduced as a diagnostic pool by performing detailed histology on myocardium. So often it's just a macroscopic exam, but if you do detailed histology, you may decrease the diagnoses of sudden arrhythmic death. So when this patient comes into the emergency department, what tests are worth doing? Well, a history and exam are important, but the reality is that an ECG is a much better screening test. This has been shown well in a paper called The Effectiveness of Screening History Physical Exam and ECG, which was a meta-analysis published in the Journal of Electrocardiology in 2015. So if someone's come in after symptoms, remember that we're not performing a screening test and that their pre-test probability for disease after syncope is going to be much higher. But we're going to talk about screening for just a little bit longer, and the reason for that is, as stated, there's been a lot of data done on this. For screening athletes, they've done the European Society of Cardiology guidelines for many years. The trouble with this is that they're relatively non-specific and have a high cost per diagnosis made. So recently, a group have come together and put together the Seattle criteria. The Seattle criteria have been proven to outperform the European Society guidelines by being just as sensitive but significantly more specific. Seattle criteria are divided into those which are normal findings, and they are really important because they help to determine what athletes can have on an ECG which don't predict for serious risk of sudden cardiac death, and that includes sinus bradycardia, and as long as it's more than 30, sinus arrhythmia, ectopic atrial rhythm and junctional escape rhythms, first degree AV block, Mobitz 1 second degree AV block, incomplete right bundle branch block, isolated voltage criteria for LVH, and that does not include secondary repolarization abnormality or atrial enlargement, and then early repolarization. So all of those criteria are actually normal in athletes. The abnormal criteria are the ones that are worth knowing about. You can look these up anywhere, but we're going to go through these in a bit more detail soon. If you screen athletes with the ECG, the history and exam, and then you take the group that you found abnormality on and investigate them, what you find are the following conditions. So Wolff-Parkinson-White, given it's quite common, occurs in around 40%. You get long QT in about 10%, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in about 10%, dilated cardiomyopathy in about 7%, coronary artery disease in about 5%, and arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy in about 3%. So in fact, the group that you find in screening is not dissimilar to the group that you find at autopsy study, with the big difference here being Wolff-Parkinson-White making up a large percentage of those found in screening. In the emergency department, we see lots of ECGs. We see ECGs on patients who are asymptomatic, so screening tests. We also see ECGs on those patients who've had significant symptoms, such as an unexplained syncope. For that reason, I do think it's the job of the emergency clinician to be absolutely across the ECG signs which can predict for sudden cardiac death in young people. The first one to know about is a wide QRS. In all the studies, a wide QRS, particularly that greater than 130 milliseconds, has a very strong association with sudden cardiac death. Now, the issue with wide QRS only is that it's a non-specific sign, because a lot of people with established cardiac disease will have a wide QRS. It's therefore very hard to differentiate out of those group who are at risk for sudden cardiac death. The way I use wide QRS in my practice is if I get a wide QRS in a relatively young, healthy person, I find that's an unexpected finding, I will do a bedside echo, check their LV out, and if I'm worried about anything in their heart, I can then accelerate a cardiology review and formal echo. So the conversation I can have is, I found a wide QRS, I've done an echo, there's a dilated cardiomyopathy with a low ejection fraction, and I can get that person in and rapidly assessed much easier. The next ECG sign to be really looking out for is downsloping ST elevation in the septal leads. Downsloping ST elevation is also known as coved ST elevation, and as you would know, coved ST elevation is almost pathognomonic for the Brugada syndrome. It's been shown recently that the coved pattern at rest has a much higher incidence of sudden cardiac death than when you've got the type 2 or type 3 pattern, or if it's induced. So some patients only get the coved pattern under flecainide stimulation or under duress, but those with it at rest have up to a 10% risk of sudden cardiac death per year, which is probably 20 times that of the other groups. There are two next features on an ECG to look out for. Firstly, there are deep needle-like Q waves found in the inferro and lateral leads, and an association with these Q waves is giant T-wave inversion found in the septal leads. So the giant T-wave inversion in the septal leads, I know that can be seen in things like subarachnoid hemorrhage, but is fairly classic for the apical variant of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The non-apical variant classically has signs of LVH and needle-like, very deep Q waves infralaterally. You also usually get significant repolarization abnormality and left atrial hypertrophy. One thing you may not have been aware of is that there is a strong association with Hokum and Wolff-Parkinson-White. So patients with a history of syncope and WPW should also have an echo as part of their workup. The mortality from sudden cardiac death is around 1 in 200 a year in those with Hokum. It's probably true that some groups of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients never develop left ventricular outflow tract obstruction and don't go on to develop dilated cardiomyopathy at the endpoint either. So they're currently trying to work out which group are those most at risk. The next ECG sign to look out for is a small upward inflection at the end of the QRS complex known as an epsilon wave. The epsilon wave is usually associated with deep septal T-wave inversion from V1 through to V3 at least. Now, the epsilon wave is absolutely specific for the arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. ARBC has recently been reclassified as the arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy because it's been shown on 4D echo and SPECT and MR studies that over time the right ventricular trouble progresses into the left ventricle. By the time you get epsilon waves, you usually have established quite late disease. So it is important that you look out for the T-wave inversion first, which will usually occur in patients well before epsilon waves. Mortality of ARVC or ACM is up to 10% annually, and that will depend on risk seen at electrophysiology studies. The next syndrome to look out for is the long QT syndrome. Long QT is actually reasonably common because it can be induced by drugs or be the congenital form, which is a sodium channel disorder. There are up to 13 subtypes of the congenital long QT syndrome, and mortality varies depending on which one you have. So it's around 0.5 to 2 per thousand per year. When you're measuring the QT, you should take the QT in three leads and then take the longest, and you should always correct for rate using the formula QT over the square root of the RR interval. Remember that one of the biggest risk factors for those with long QT is commencing a new medication such as antipsychotic or erythromycin, which has the effect of increasing their QT interval. The next syndrome worth talking about is Wolff-Parkinson-White. You should be all aware of the classic features, which is a short PR interval, the delta wave from ventricular pre-excitation, and a broad QRS complex, which sometimes have a bundle branch-like appearance. The important thing to know is that the degree of these signs will depend on, to some extent, the distance that the accessory pathway is from the AV node. So some of the paranodal accessory pathways really have very, very subtle delta waves and very little in the way of wide QRS. It's important that you've got a high index of suspicion. Thankfully for WPW, given how common it is, the mortality is quite low at around 0.25% per year. And it's true that it's probably only those who antidromically conduct arrhythmias through their accessory pathway who are at risk of death. The most risk are those who have pre-excited AF, particularly those who get pre-excited AF with rapid rates, or those with multiple accessory pathways. There is still some controversy about whether people with WPW patterns on ECG should go for electrophysiology evaluation. And the reason for that is that EP studies do have a significant mortality, often which approaches that of Wolff-Parkinson-White. So the ones I definitely want to send to EP studies are patients with WPW pattern who've had unexplained syncope or those with documented pre-excited AF on ECG. The next sign to look out for in ECG is a very short QT, often with no ST segment, and very tall, narrow T waves. So this is actually pathognomonic of the short QT syndrome. The trouble is that the syndrome itself is far less common than the short QT interval seen on ECG. It's quite rare, but has high mortality, and it's kind of important to make sure that you're screening for this, but if there's no symptoms whatsoever, probably you don't need to get too excited. You do really look for a QTC of less than 330 milliseconds, although by definition it is less than 360. And remember that the T waves are very tall and peak with a narrow base, and the ST segment is usually missing. The next thing to look out for is signs of early repolarization. Now, it's basically just changed its name from benign early repolarization to early repolarization. And this is because of a few studies that have noticed a strong association with unexplained VF and an early repolarization pattern on the ECG. You know the signs of early repolarization. That's concave, upward, ST elevation, particularly in the septal and inferior leads, usually associated with a small J wave, particularly from V3 to V5. And the interesting thing here is that this pattern, as you know, is very common in fit young people. It's up to 30% of people in the military, but it's about 5 to 13% of the general population. If you look at the absolute risk of VF in early repolarization, it's measured as a hazard ratio of around 1.7. The reality is that across the board, though, early repolarization is probably not dangerous, but there is going to be a subgroup, which hopefully we'll find soon, who have increased risk for VF. So again, what I suggest is that if someone has no symptoms of syncope or palpitations and an early repolarization pattern on their ECG, I think that can be safely put on the back burner. But if you're looking at a patient with recurrent syncopal events, unexplained faints, and they have early repolarization, particularly those with more than 0.2 millivolts of ST elevation, I think you should take those ones more seriously and potentially refer them for electrophysiology follow-up. The other thing that's worth talking about when we talk about sudden cardiac death is a pattern that occurs in older people, which is the combination of a right bundle branch block, a prolonged PR interval, so primary AV block, and left axis deviation with either a left anterior hemi block or left posterior hemi block. This is known together as the trifascicular block, and the reason to look out for it, because although Framingham and other longitudinal studies showed that the chance of getting third-degree AV block is only about 1 to 2% per year, it's true that if someone's presented with a history of syncope and a trifascicular block, it puts them in a risk group which would suggest that they should have a pacemaker inserted. So obviously if you catch the patient in third-degree AV block, there's no problems, but if someone's had a history of syncope and a third-degree AV block and it's not reversible, such as stopping their calcium channel blocker, that patient should probably have pacemaker insertion. So they're the main ECG signs to look out for. I just want to quickly talk to you about some of the future markers that are coming. Firstly, there's the fragmented QRS. So this looks a bit like an ugly bundle branch block with maybe an RS, R prime, R prime sort of pattern. This is a marker of myocardial fibrosis or scarring, and myocardial fibrosis or scarring is a strong risk for sudden cardiac death. They have not quite got fragmented QRS sorted in terms of what qualifies, what's a bundle, what's an IVCD instead. But when they do, this is going to be a marker to particularly look out for. And I think, again, if you're seeing ugly looking QRS complexes with fragmentation patterns, you should be thinking in the patient with unexplained syncope that they need more follow-up. Heart rate variability and turbulence is interesting because variability of heart rate is an index of parasympathetic function, and lower variability is linked to increased risk of sudden cardiac death. These markers have been best studied in post-MI patients, and they're better if combined with other ECG markers as well. So the heart rate should vary up and down with respiration and movement, but it's sort of fixed at one point. That's an indicator. The other one is this heart rate turbulence. So normally if you have a ventricular ectopic beat, you get a compensatory pause, followed by a speed up in your heart rate. If you don't do that, so you don't get any speed up in your heart rate as a compensation, it predicts sudden cardiac death in post-AMI patients. It's something you could watch on a monitor at work. T-wave markers are the next sign And it's not surprising because T-wave markers are an index of ventricular repolarization. Damage to a ventricle causes changes in repolarization. So firstly, there's T-wave alternans, which is beat-to-beat change in T-wave size or polarity. Now, normally you can see this at high heart rates, but if the heart rate's less than 110, then T-wave alternans is abnormal. It's particularly abnormal if associated with a narrow QRS. So if you're seeing normal-looking QRS and T-wave alternans on an ECG in a patient with a history of syncope, be concerned. The final T-wave marker is the time it takes from the peak of the T-wave to the end of the T-wave, which is a measure of repolarization time. And that's been quite well shown to have a longer time which is associated with sudden cardiac death. Again, this is a marker which has been studied as we speak, and it may come into more prominence in the future. So to summarise the findings we're looking for in sudden cardiac death, I think you've probably seen that T-wave inversion in the septal leads is usually bad, and it's sometimes a sign of AMI, it's sometimes a sign of posterior infarct, it's sometimes a sign of HOCM, it's sometimes a sign of arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy. So T-wave inversion septally in the post-adolescent patient and inferiorly is bad. Congruent S2 depression in two or more leads is bad. Pathological Q waves in two or more leads is bad. And left ventricular hypertrophy with associated repolarization abnormality or signs of left atrial hypertrophy indicates that the LVH is not just a compensatory pattern, but is pathology. So the next time someone comes into your emergency department with a history of syncope, remember that the cause could have been a sudden cardiac arrhythmia. Think about those signs on an ECG which help predict for one of the causes of the sudden arrhythmic death syndrome or one of the causes of structural heart disease which cause death in young people. If you have any concerns, don't be afraid to aggressively refer these patients on for emergent cardiac workup. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. If you go to www.tickme.com.au, you can interact with this, you can look at the ECGs in terms of the video podcast, and you can ask any questions you like online.